Good evening and welcome to the March 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, since the first week Donald Trump retook office, he and his administration have been targeting the transgender community with a barrage of executive orders that seek to do everything from taking away access to gender-affirming care to removing the existence of transgender identities. Tonight, we talk with Nico Lang. He's an award-winning journalist and author about how all of this is impacting, in particular, transgender youth. His new book is titled American Teenager: How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. He's coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, March 23rd, 2025. I'd love to change the world. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of March 23rd, 2025. The country of Hungary, which is led by anti-LGBTQ plus authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, is seeking to ban the Pride celebration in Budapest and use facial recognition software to identify those who attend if it's held in defiance of the ban. Hungarian officials say they were emboldened to do this by Donald Trump. Hungary is also considering a constitutional amendment that would say the nation recognizes only two genders, male and female, mirroring an executive order issued by Trump. According to the Associated Press, a bill to ban the Pride March was introduced into Parliament last week, and it would make it an offense to hold or attend events that violate Hungary's contentious child protection legislation, which prohibits, quote, the depiction or promotion of homosexuality to minors, end quote. The bill is expected to pass as Orban's ruling coalition has two-thirds of the seat in parliament. Orban is a close ally of Trump and had hinted at banning the event at his annual State of the Nation address. David Pressman, the American ambassador to Hungary under President Joe Biden, resigned in January, just a few days ahead of Trump's inauguration, and he had been a fierce critic of Orban's administration. Orban has led Hungary since 2010, but his support may be eroding. He's up for re-election in 2026. And here in the U.S., one day after the Department of Justice lawyers struggled to explain the need for a ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. Armed Forces, the Trump administration's aggressive efforts to purge transgender service members from the military have taken another step forward. The U.S. Department of the Navy has issued formal procedures for the removal of transgender personnel, filing the directive in federal court last week as part of an ongoing legal battle. The new guidance orders the Navy and Marine Corps to begin involuntary separations of service members with a history of gender dysphoria after March 28th, 2 days after a previous March 26th deadline for voluntary separations. This is, of course, unless they obtain a so-called waiver, which according to legal experts is nothing more than an illusion. Trump administration claims the waiver provides a path for transgender troops to remain in service, but critics and attorneys involved in the case say the requirements are designed to be impossible to meet. For a waiver to even be considered, service members must have lived their assigned sex at birth for 36 consecutive months, never attempted a gender transition, and be willing to adhere to all military standards associated with their sex assigned at birth. In short, the waiver is only available to those who are not and have never been transgender. And in a related story, the Department of Veterans Affairs announced last week that it will immediately phase out all gender-affirming care medical treatments for transgender veterans, citing President Donald Trump's January 20th executive order defining gender as strictly being male or female and fixed at birth. The decision, effective immediately, halts access to cross-sex hormone therapy for transgender veterans unless they were already receiving it through the VA or military at the time of their discharge. All other medical care for gender dysphoria, including speech therapy and prosthetics, such as chest binders and wigs, have been discontinued. Veterans Affairs Secretary Doug Collins said, quote, I mean no disrespect to anyone, but the VA should not be focused on helping veterans' attempts to change their sex. The vast majority of veterans and Americans agree, and this is why this is the correct decision, end quote. All major medical associations in the U.S. support gender-affirming health care for transgender people. The VA claims, though, that savings from eliminating gender-affirming care would be redirected to support veterans with severe injuries, including amputees and paralyzed veterans. And here locally, Napa Valley College announced it'll be hosting a screening of Sally, a documentary about the Bay Area feminist and lesbian Sally Gearhart. Gearhart is credited with helping defeat Proposition 6 right alongside Harvey Milk. This amazing documentary will show on Thursday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Napa Valley College Performing Arts Center. The filmmakers will be in attendance and doing a talk back after the film. You can get more information and information about tickets on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click the icon in the center of the page. If you have a local LGBTQ news story, announcement, or an event you'd like to share with our listeners in this segment, tell us about it by going to our website at outbeatnews.com. Just click the Submit Event button at the top of the page. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglia. My guest tonight is Nico Lang, a non-binary, award-winning journalist with over a decade of experience covering the transgender community's fight for equality. Their work has appeared in major publications, including Rolling Stone, Esquire, The New York Times, Vox, The Wall Street Journal, Salon, and many others. Their industry-leading contributions to queer media have resulted in a GLAAD Media Award and 10 awards from the National Association of LGBTQ Journalists. Last October, Nico published a book titled American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Nico, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for being here. If you hear a purring cat in the background, my cat has decided to take an interest in me right now that I've picked up the phone, because of course she did.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, the cat is welcome to the show as well.
I see what you did there. Very cute.
Yeah. that was not intentional, but I'll take it. Before we get talking about this book and all the stuff going on with the transgender community right now, especially with our young people, give our listeners a little bit of your background, where you grew up, and your coming out process.
Sure. I grew up in Cincinnati, sort of like on the outskirts of Cincinnati in rural Ohio, in a place that no one would have ever heard of. But I actually really liked it. I was lucky enough to go to a pretty good high school with really good friends who I kept in touch with as an adult. So I know a lot of my queer friends have pretty like tortured relationships with their like childhoods and like places that they grew up. But mm-hmm. I actually have a good relationship with mine. So that feels really nice. It's a nice little gift for myself. Like every time I go back home, I like hang out with all my friends from high school and it's really lovely. And that feels like really rare and I'm very appreciative for it. But I didn't, you know, come out as non-binary. Like I was out queer. I was out as queer in high school. And for the most part, I think people were okay about it. Luckily, I was really weird. So, and like genuinely weird, not in a like, you know, performative teenage way. So I think if anybody was going to pick on me, they were going to go for like 10 other reasons before me being queer. I just don't think it rated, you know, in the constellation. But I didn't come out as non-binary until college because I just didn't know it was a thing. Like I didn't know that was an option for me.
Sure.
I'd always, you know, I kind of just felt like genderless in a way. Like I related to mannequins, if that makes any sense. And I remember even when I was a kid, the Barbies confused me because I then thought that everybody looked like that. And the idea of like, you know, like essentially gender, just like I was like, wait, what? It took me a really surprisingly long time to figure out how human anatomy worked, because I don't know, I just thought we were all the same in a way. And I think I've always just felt inherently kind of like nothing, but in a way that I like and that feels nice for me. Mm-hmm. And I struggled to put a name to those feelings until college when, you know, there was like a word that was presented to me. First, it was genderqueer, which I never really liked because genderqueer more suggests that you're like maybe somewhere in between or like, you know, messing with the colors a bit. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas mm-hmm. for me, it wasn't the idea of like both and, it was neither nor. So I think when I learned a little bit more and the wide variety of options really presented itself to me, I was able to go, oh, this makes more sense. Because mm-hmm. it was really less like a coming out process than knowing that I even had something to come out as.
Sure. Sure. And I mean, relatively speaking in our history, our understanding of gender is still very new. I think we'll talk about this later, but you know, I think that's kind of at the root of this whole problem with the federal government and all of these old people that are making policy decisions is they just don't really understand it. aside from ignoring all the science. But again, we'll get to that. What attracted you to journalism? I mean, you're quite an accomplished writer.
Oh, God, I just don't think I'm that good at anything else. Like, I'd started out being a film critic, and I was okay with edit. You know, I grew up reading Roger Ebert's reviews, and I think I just wanted to be like Roger Ebert. You know, he was so, like, warm and wise and thoughtful, and he had this knowledge, just not about film, but about the world. Like, every one of his reviews was filled with, like, thoughts about literature and references to these things, and I just thought that I thought that I wanted to be that kind of person, you know, who had that knowledge about life, who had those kinds of experiences. And I think I mistook that for wanting to be a film critic. Then I was a film critic, and it didn't make me happy. And to be honest, I wasn't great at it. There were other film critics that I thought were writing really, like, fabulous reviews and contributing something really meaningful to the form, but I just don't think I was that person. And around, you know, 2015, 2016 is when we really saw the rise of the far right and the rise of Donald Trump. That was when we saw the anti-trans bathroom bill in North Carolina, which targeted restroom use in public spaces, and hearing about how that affected people and affected people's lives. Everything I'd been doing before just felt so silly. Like, no one cares what I thought about Interstellar. Like, I thought it was bad. Congratulations, I saved you reading my review. But telling the stories of people who had been affected, you know, spending time with them, getting to know them and uplifting their voices just felt like the best thing that I could possibly do with my time. And then on top of that, it turned out I was a lot better at that than I had been those other things. Like, I very briefly went to journalism school in undergrad, but I got kind of sidetracked. My sort of professor mentor at the time had told me that if I was really serious about journalism, that I should pursue it for grad school. And I was like, okay, well, great. I guess I'll do it for grad school and do something else. So I did international studies in undergrad, which I really loved because I got to take a ton of languages and learn about the world, which we've sort of established was kind of my goal to begin with. But then when we got around to grad school, I ended up distracted doing something else. So journalism, in a way, found me anyway. And I think it was just like fate that sometimes, like, what you do in life chooses you, you don't choose it. And I think that just kind of happened to me, my calling.
Yeah, I get it.
It called me.
I get it. And I'm glad it did. Tell us about the GLAAD Award.
Oh, God, there's nothing much to say. I was in the bathroom. That's a lie. I was going to the bathroom to try to run to get to the bathroom before the award was announced. And then I ran into an old friend that I've never met in real life. We'd never run into each other. Mm-hmm. And because we only know each other through the internet in the way that a lot of journalists only know each other through the internet. And she looked so amazing. And I was so happy to see her that I was just, like, regaling her presence. And then my category was called. So now I get to say, like, oh, I was in the bathroom, even though that's, like, not totally true. But other than that, I don't know. There's not really that much to say about it. I'd wanted one for a long time. I was nominated for, like, a million times, and I just kept going for it. And then eventually persistence won out, you know? And so sometimes in life, it really does matter to just want things and to want them a lot.
Sure. And GLAAD's very prestigious. Was there a particular piece of writing that you did that got their attention this time, or what was it?
Well, the one that I actually won for, that was a piece for the Daily Beast about how Alabama was effectively denying driver's licenses to trans people until the age of 19. And that I was really happy that won because I got to meet a friend that way. One of the people that I focused on in that article has, like, since become a friend, and I just love her so much. And seeing her story uplifted that way, I know, meant a lot to her. To be honest, I don't think that was my best writing, and I think that a lot of other stories, like, could have won or maybe should have, but I'm really glad for her. Like, I'm glad that she got to have that moment, and that felt really cool. And this year they haven't announced anything yet. I think it's at the beginning or at the end of March, but I'm not sure because it's different this year. They're like kind of changing up how they do things because it got nominated for – there's like an independent journalism category. And my Instagram account, which all of you should follow, Queer News Daily, was nominated for that. It's totally not going to win. Erin Reed's going to win that like hands down, and she should win. But then on top of that, I got nominated for a piece that I did for HuffPost about the trans refugee crisis, which is something I've sort of been doing yearly for them, that we check in on like the state of trans rights in the US. And my most recent piece was about all the people who really want to move from hostile states that are taking away gender affirming care or other forms of trans rights and can't because they don't have money. And I don't, that was something that I'd never seen anyone talk about, that, you know, being able to move is kind of a privilege, right? Not everybody can do it. Privilege is not like, I think we sometimes use it in a pejorative sense, right? That, right. Oh, you're privileged and that's bad. But like privilege is a good thing, right? Everybody should have privilege. But the thing is that a lot of people don't. So, so for these families who are stuck in these places, I just wanted to check in and ask, like, you know, how are you doing? How does it feel? And some, you know, some families genuinely don't want to move, but others very much do. So it's like, you know, how do you negotiate that? And I just never seen an article really focusing on that. So I was really glad that I got to write it. And I'm glad that Glad recognized it. That felt really nice. It was a good little present.
How tragic it is that, I mean, typically when we talk about migration or immigration, right, we think about people fleeing other countries where they're oppressed. How sad is it that people within our own country are having to flee states because they don't feel safe?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But I think we sometimes don't focus enough on all the people who are trying to like stay and fight and who are really giving up like a lot of safety in order to do that, because it's a really great sacrifice to stay in these places that are unsafe for you and to try to make them safer. You see queer activists in the South who have been doing this for such a long time. And I know, you know, in a way that's like a privilege too, because it's the privilege of knowing that you can stay and fight, that, you know, at some level, hoping and thinking that things are going to be okay for you. So I think that privilege maybe cuts both ways, but it's just such a great gift to all of us to do, like the people who are continuing to do this work, who are building their lives around doing this work, and doing so at tremendous personal sacrifice to themselves. And I just, you know, I'm so grateful for that. And I think we should all be grateful for that. And I don't think we take time enough to think about those folks who are staying and trying to do something about this.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. Well, your book is called American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Where did the idea for this and the motivation for this book come from?
Yeah, people sort of get the gist of it in the intro. But during the pandemic, I think it was early pandemic, but like time's a flat circle, and I don't remember how anything happened anymore. I was on the phone with Kimberly Shapley, who's a longtime source of mine, who's kind of become a friend. I know that we're like not supposed to become friends with like the people we cover, but I don't know. Like I talk to this woman like every week now. So like try not to be friends with somebody that you're in contact with all the time. Mm-hmm. And in her state, the lawmakers had recently introduced a bill that would brand parents of trans youth as being child abusers if they allow their kids to socially or medically transition. And just, you know, hearing her distress on the phone and just listening to this woman, for lack of a better way to put it, freak out, you know, it really affected me, because I'd always naively operated under the assumption that there was some good faith in this discussion, right? That even if Republicans had these questions about trans kids, that, you know, they wanted at the end of the day what was best for them and what was best for their families. Like, don't we all want what's best for children, right? And how silly of me to think that way. Because then I realized, actually, I don't think that there are a lot of people operating here in good faith. I think that there are a lot of people who don't want what's best for these kids. So I knew that I needed to do something to respond to this in some way, to like ease her pain, or at least try, because, you know, of course, there's nothing I can do to like change the law or like, you know, fix people's hearts. But I am a journalist and I can tell stories. And that's, you know, that's my response to things. So my response was to double down on the storytelling that I was doing to try to answer that kind of hate. with a book that would center the voices of trans kids and their families and the people that love them, that would center love. It just felt like that was the only thing that I could really do. And it's the only thing I really know how to do. But, you know, I could do it. So I did. There wasn't anything stopping me. And this book, you know, it's really written for the kind of – well, it's written for two things. First, it's written for trans youth to feel like their voices matter, and to feel like they're being heard. I think that's the most important thing, for trans youth to be able to pick up this book and recognize their stories in it, to recognize the stories of their friends and community members, to go like, oh, this feels like our lives. You know, it feels like this book gets it. You know, I want people to feel reflected. I think that that can be a really powerful experience for people. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, for those folks who don't have a trans person in their lives and who are spreading this misinformation and hate, you know, there are two things here. I want them to see the population that they're impacting. You know, I want them to meet the Kimberlys of the world and her daughter, Kai, and to see the people that they're hurting. I want them to be forced to get to know them. But then on top of it, the hope, and, you know, I don't know if this is still naive of me, is that through learning about these people and their stories and getting the chance to kind of fall in love with them a little, because they are so wonderful, you can learn the error of your ways. You can think differently. You can, through the power of falling in love with someone, realize that there's a better way and that it doesn't have to be like this. Like, of course, at the end of the day, my goal is always to try to not only change hearts and minds, but change behavior, mm-hmm. right? To get people to stop doing this to kids and their families. And I don't know if I'll ever really have that power. I've been trying for a long time to change people's hearts. And, you know, we still did what we did in the 2024 election. But it's like, I've got to keep trying, you know, I've got to keep putting people's stories out there and hoping that it makes a difference. You know, I don't know if it will, but unfortunately, I don't really have any other hobbies. So this is pretty much my hobby. It's like this and watching The Traitors. That's about it.
So the book came out in October of 2024. So obviously you'd been working on it for some time before that. Did you foresee this re-election happening?
No. I mean, I want to be like that person who's like, I saw it all coming, girl. I saw it all coming. But that's not true. In 2016, I genuinely thought he was going to win because all of my friends in Europe were freaking out and they were freaking me out. And it was making me really get in my head. And then it turned out all my friends in Europe were right. Because I guess, like, you know, France was, like, just convinced that Donald Trump was going to win. Those mm-hmm. French people knew something that we did not. But this time around, I don't know, with how awful the first 4 years of his presidency had been and, you know, just what a misery they had been and what bad shape the country had been in. I just – there was a part of me that thought we wouldn't do this again. Like, why would we self-inflict this kind of wound if we didn't have to? Like, no one's forcing us to elect this man again. You know, we're choosing to do this. And it's like, yeah, Kamala was flawed in a lot of, like, very profound ways. You know, I don't think that Democrats handled Gaza well. There were a bunch of issues that I had with the campaign and how it had handled things. But I genuinely thought we wouldn't choose the greater of two evils. You know, I thought that things could be different. And again, I think I had some naive view that if I just told people's stories, I kept doing my job, that people would listen. On the day of the election, for that hour that Kamala was doing well, because, you know, for a minute, it looked like she was doing okay. And I was like, you know, I think I got a little too ahead of myself. And I texted my sort of longtime work wife, and I told her that it made me really happy because it made me feel like people got it, that we'd done something, that people had learned. Mm-hmm. And then when that's not the way that things went, I took it really hard and I took it really personally. I think it was maybe my own just like narcissism or something. Mm-hmm. But I felt like I had like personally failed, that I hadn't done enough. That this was my fault. And I talked to a lot of people who were like that. And that's what made me feel better, because I at first, I think I like felt like I was feeling uniquely bad and I was the only person who felt this way. But a lot of activists particularly struggled with that same sense of guilt, that we all could have prevented this somehow. But I think slowly I've been able to let go of that. Luckily, I started Prozac and I started beta blockers, which has been incredible. I recommend it to everyone. Please get yourself some Prozac. It's life-changing. But I've also just tried to stay recommitted to telling people stories as like a net good in itself, to not think about the outcome, to not think about like trying to change things or change policy, but just to make people feel heard in all of this. That, you know, just as before, I don't really have that many gifts that I can give people, but if I can make someone's day a little bit better, you know, amid the fall of democracy, by feeling heard for a second, you know, that's really what keeps me going.
So how did you find the contributors, the individuals who shared their stories with you?
Oh, gosh, it's not a very interesting answer. I'm a journalist. I've been doing this for a long time. I know a lot of people, so it was just mostly referrals, you know. Some of the families I already knew from my reporting, and the ones that I didn't, you know, it was like a Quality Texas reaching out to people in their networks. It was Quality Florida reaching out to people in their networks. Somebody just like dropped me a DM on Instagram, you know. It was reaching out to AAPI groups, because I felt like there hasn't been enough queer storytelling in the AAPI space. There's been some really great, like, great stuff, obviously. But I have a friend, Jen Richards, who always says that the answer to every problem of representation is more representation. And I knew that if I just wanted to see more queer Asian stories be represented, that other people probably wanted that too. So it just felt me, like it was my responsibility in some way to make sure that those stories and those voices were included. So I just reached out to groups who I knew could put me in touch with people. And, that's bing, bang, boom. That's how it happened. That's really pretty much it. But I feel good about the folks that I picked. I tried to go first, not with this kind of like programmatic idea or like checking boxes, but I focused on stories that I felt really connected to and that I felt like I really got. Like the Muslim family in the book, I think everybody always assumes that I picked them because they're Muslim. And that's not true. I mean, part of it is that my minor was in Islamic world studies, and I'm really glad that I got to use that finally. Really came in handy. But on top of that, I really like got this woman. Like our stories were so the same in a lot of different ways, because she'd struggled with her parents in these specific ways about carving out space for herself as a woman and to be a free-spirited, independent woman who's a Muslim. And I struggled with my family just in terms of asserting my own independence and my voice, like who I wanted to be, not in like a queer way. I think that they've actually been really good about, but just that we were really different people who wanted different things from the world and from life. And I think my family for a long time struggled with what I wanted and how that was different from what they wanted, right? And I knew that if there was this commonality between us, between the mom and I, her name's Maha, we call her in the book, then we could build something from there. Because you need that sort of like that trust. You need to be able to build from some sense of relation. And I knew that we could do something really special with that. I knew I could use that to go really deep with this family and to tell a really meaningful story. And I hope that I was right. People can tell me if I was right. I'm really proud of it, and I know that they are too. So that's the thing that I try to focus on.
Nice. Well, I'm teaching high school students in the other part of my life, and I know that under even normal, regular, non-political circumstances, that trying to figure out who they are and how to figure out life is awful. I think all of us can think back to our high school time and probably relate a bit to that. But for those kids who are really trying to figure out their gender identity, it's really challenging right now when they discover that, you know, it doesn't align with their birth sex. How have you seen Donald Trump make this so much worse for kids?
Oh God, how much time do you have? I mean, all of his executive orders are designed to eradicate and erase trans people. I mean, it's like, this sounds like hyperbole, and I think people dismiss it as hyperbole, but it's not. Like, the White House is openly backing detransition events today for, like, National Detrans Day. And if somebody is listening to this who is a detransitioner, like, I understand that people have had lots of different experiences. And if that's been the right decision for somebody for a lot of different reasons, I don't want to invalidate that. But you have to look at what the White House is actually doing here. And they're trying to make it as hard as possible at every level for people to be trans. Like, you look at passports, right? The first thing that Trump did was not to ban gender-affirming care. It's to ban trans people from getting passports, right? And if you can't get a passport that accurately reflects who you are, it makes it harder to move around in the world. It makes it harder to get other forms of identification. For a long time, a passport was the easiest thing to get. It was the first thing I got that had my name on it before I got anything else, because it made it then easier to get my state ID. It mm-hmm. made it easier to get my Social Security card updated, right? And a lot of trans people do the same thing. So if you can't get an accurate passport now, you might not be able to get your state ID. You might not be able to get those other things updated. And then on top of that, you know, it's sports, it's gender-affirming care, it's trans women being forced into men's prisons. It's all of these things, but it's just about making trans people's lives harder at every single level. That if you can't get an accurate ID, if you can't get health care, if you can't even be like housed in jail, you know, correctly, right? If you can't use the bathroom in public, which is, you know, happening in different states across the country, that they are restricting the places that trans people can use the restroom safely. Like, it's just really hard to be yourself. It's hard to participate in society. So that's what they're trying to do. And it's not just for kids, it's for everybody. Right. Like, it's important, of course, that we focus on the impact on kids, because I think kids are going to be the most psychologically affected by all this. Because it just matters when you're like 15 what people think of you, particularly your elected lawmakers. I think it matters a lot more. But it's also adults too. Like, a lot of the hospitals that have shut down gender affirming care because of Trump's executive orders, they've done it for everybody, not just for kids. Like, I was interviewing a guy in South Dakota yesterday who lost his gender affirming care because the hospital that he had got it through no longer offers gender affirming care anymore. And through his insurance provider, that's the only place he's allowed to go. So he's had to start going to a Planned Parenthood in another state in order to get his gender affirming care and paying out of pocket. Like, I interviewed somebody the other day who, every time she goes to Colombia, the country, she stocks up on her hormones while she's there just in case there's a shortage. So it just, and you know, this is a woman who's in her 70s, right? So people are having to adapt to this in really absurd, surreal ways. And I just don't think the average American really understands how hard it is to be a trans person in this country right now, and mm-hmm. how hard this president is making it for trans people. And that's very much on purpose.
Well,
that's the intent.
Yeah. And I think, you know, some legal experts are really challenging the validity of many of these executive orders, but their impact is regardless very, very significant. Whether they're going to withstand a test in court or not remains to be seen. Whether they're really enforceable or not remains to be seen. But these executive orders seem to be really impacting people's attitudes and their decision-making. For example, the hospital you mentioned. If, in fact, these orders don't really have any legal weight, and a hospital administrator decides to proactively respond to it, the damage is real, whether that order is legal or not.
But here's the thing, though, is they're not even listening to the court rulings about a lot of these executive orders. Like, for instance, the one I referenced about gender-affirming care in prison and allowing trans prisoners to be housed in accordance with their gender identity, a court just ruled that the policy should be put on hold as the court case moves through the system. You know, it has like a what they call like a temporary injunction, right? And the Trump administration has been transferring trans women to men's prisons anyway. They just didn't listen. Because I think that we've always operated under this idea that if there were a court ruling, the president would just follow it. But this president has shown time and again that he has no regard for the law. He doesn't care about court rulings. He doesn't care about doing what's right or what's legal or what's ethical or what's moral. He's just going to do whatever he wants. He's going to do whatever he feels will play to his base. And if it means that he needs to fly in the face of a court ruling, then so be it. Like, who's going to tell him no?
Yeah, it's terrifying, isn't it?
Yes, it's terrifying is a light word. I feel like the only word to describe what we like, what it feels like to be alive right now, has to exist in German. Like, I was telling a friend that there needs to be a word that means like horrible and okay at the same time, where we're all like, we're all doing bad, but somehow we're like still here. And I don't know what emotion encapsulates all that, but if somebody knows the German word for it, please get back to me.
Well, amongst all of this, there's a lot of bad information out there. I mean, let's just call it what it is. And a lot of that false information has to do with what affirming care or what affirming gender care actually is, especially for those under the age of 18. You've done a lot of research on this. You know a lot about it. For our listeners, what does gender affirming care for someone who's not an adult look like?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a lot of different things. People get like hung up on this idea of like, oh, the irreversible surgeries for children. There was this guy when I was at Frisco Pride several months ago. He came up to me and he's like, oh, what do you feel about 13-year-olds getting irreversible surgeries? And I looked at him and I was like, sir, I don't have to have an opinion on that because it's like it's not happening. But I just asked him, what made you want to ask me that today? Like, what's going on? And he told me about these like right-wing talking points that he'd been reading online and, you know, and blah, 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 all this, you know, misinformation and disinformation. And I just listened for a while and I heard him out because he was there with two trans kids. So I assumed at some level there had to be some good faith here. He's got two trans kids. And at the end of it, you know, when he was done talking, I just talked about the book and I talked about my experience knowing these kids, that seeing them being able to transition. And a lot of this is really just socially transitioning, right? It's like a lot of kids aren't really ready for any kind of big interventions. They just want to use their name and they want to use their pronouns and they want to dress the way that they want to, in the same way that I wanted to dress the way I wanted to as a 13-year-old kid. And if my family put me in some dumb sweater I didn't like, I would change into what I wanted to wear at school, right? It's like mostly that. It's just kids wanting to express themselves and their identities to be themselves the best way that they know how. But, you know, when some kids are already, there are other things other than that. You can take puberty blockers that are reversible and they just give people time to make those bigger decisions, because this isn't something any family rushes into, right? It's not something any kid rushes into. And I think people want enough time to be able to make those decisions for themselves and be able to make them in the best way for not only them, but their families too, right? And at the right time. And then, you know, there are things that come later, like HRT and surgery. And when kids are old enough to make that decision and feel like, you know, they're ready and their families are ready, it can be such a great benefit to their lives. You know, Ridian, who's one of the kids in the book, he finally got top surgery not too long ago. And he just seems so happy now. This is something he's wanted for himself for such a long time and something he's had to wait for such a long time. And I think he didn't know if the day would ever come, and it had been or caused him such anxiety that wondering if it was ever going to happen. Sure. And, you know, every time he looked at himself in the mirror, he had to look at somebody who doesn't reflect the person that he wants to see. You know, he would always talk about the shape of his body and he would like bury himself in like sweater after sweater, you know, these really baggy hoodies. And he just, you could see him sort of like lean into himself to prevent people from looking at him. And now he just has this like confidence about him when I see him. I just saw him when I was in Alabama and he looked so great. He looked so happy. And sure, like all of this crap is going on in Alabama right now, to where lawmakers are trying to make it impossible for him to be him. But it's like in Ridian's life, everything seemed good. He was beaming, he was shining. And that's what I want for every kid. You know, I want them to be able to get to be themselves on their own terms, whatever that looks like. And that support is just so many different things. It all gets bound down to like, or boiled down to just surgery, right? Irreversible surgeries. And I hear that again and again. But it's so myriad these things. It's social support. It's emotional support. It's just giving kids the space to be themselves and to figure it out. That's exactly what every kid needs. And kids, you know, who are trans just have like different particular needs when it comes to figuring themselves out. Yeah. But they need that the same way that we all did when we were kids. So when people read this book, I hope they remember what it was like to be a kid. I hope they remember what it was like to be 16 and 17 and to have some empathy for people who are still going through that and still figuring themselves out. It seems like they figured out their gender and they figured out, like, they know who they are there. It's just figuring out the rest of their lives, right? And we've got to help them do that.
Right. And all of those examples of what you called social transition are reversible, right? These are not permanent life-altering decisions, but they may provide a foundation to give that young person a better understanding of who they are so that they can make good decisions when they are an adult and are in a position to be able to do something that is perhaps more permanent. But I want to talk about those who have begun hormone therapy. You mentioned hormone blockers, and those are very easily reversible. But those who have started hormone therapy, that's a more serious step. And these executive orders that are preventing access to hormones are putting people's welfare in jeopardy, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you can see it in the book. I don't really like to talk about the specifics of science all too much, just because I think there are people who are really qualified to do that. Like, interview Jack Turbin if you want to talk about, like, the science of gender affirming care. Mm-hmm. He's really got it for you. But, you know, I can talk about the experiences of the kids that I've worked with, right? That when – so the sixth chapter in the book is about Jack and Augie, who are two trans siblings in Florida. And at the time when I visited, Jack was – oh, God, I'm so bad at kids' ages. I think she was 19 at the time. But when she was 17, she lost her gender-affirming care for 5 months because Florida had decided to ban Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming care for kids. So if you were a kid on that program, you were just booted off. Like, that was it. There was no, like, tapering off. There was no, like, grace period. You were just done. So she went from having her estrogen to one day suddenly not. And so for 5 months, she had to completely go without it, to go cold turkey. And it was a tremendously difficult time in her life and her family's lives. For 5 months, she barely left her room. She would sit in the dark every single day because she was so scared of seeing herself in the mirror or like catching a glimpse of her arm. And she got so skinny because she stopped eating that her mom would sit beside her every night because she was worried about Jack's heart stopping in her sleep. And it just breaks my heart when I talk about it or when I think about it, because Jack is just such a lovely girl. And to know she's experienced this trauma and this pain, it just hurts me. It was horrible to hear that this person that you like really care for had gone through this these horrible, horrible things. And I'm happy because Jack's in a really good place now. She did eventually get her gender-affirming care back, right? And she's 19 now, and she moved out of the state. And she has a boyfriend. It seems like they're doing well. He likes David Lynch, so I approve. And she's got a job, and she's thinking about going back to college in the fall. She's planning to go to community college. And I think that's all really wonderful. And when she texts me now, there's like this kind of bubbliness like in her text that kind of surprises me. Mm-hmm. Because when we met, she just seemed like she'd really given up on life. It felt like she'd given up on this world that had caused her so much pain. So to see her like thriving in some small way, it makes me really happy. But I also know how hard she worked to get here. And it shouldn't have had to be this hard, because it's like, I don't think people realize she was a 17-year-old girl who was tortured by her own government. She was tortured. And no person should ever have to go through that, to be tortured by your own elected leaders, but especially not a 17-year-old. Again, think about your life when you were 17.
Right.
Think about how hard it would have been for you. And my heart breaks for her. I'm so happy for her. And I want everything for her in the world, but it just shouldn't have had to be this hard to get here. You know, gender-affirming care should be a right. It should be innate.
And I think the thing that bothers me the most about all of it is we have legislators making decisions, medical decisions, without a medical degree, when all of the science is pointing us in that in the direction of supporting gender-affirming care, right? So we've got the American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, American Medical Association, and others, scientists, doctors who understand all of this, who are pretty clear on the way we need to support young people and adults, right? And then we have legislators out there that are making these ridiculous decisions.
I think for me, you can tell a lot here because these people don't want to make it better, right? If there were a conversation about like, oh, we just want kids to have the best healthcare, and we want all of this healthcare to be, you know, administered in the best way, the most ethical way, you know, the best medications, blah, 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 that would be great, right? But they're not doing that. They're just trying to take it away. Like even in, I believe it was Montana or South Dakota, when they passed their gender-affirming care ban there, there was an amendment that was put forward that would have extended greater mental health coverage. Like, I believe it was free mental health coverage, you know, for kids who would be affected by this, to help them make it to 18. So that way, if their healthcare was taken away, they would have somebody to talk about that with and somebody to help them navigate it. Mm-hmm. Republicans voted that down because they don't care. They don't really care about these kids. They don't want to make their healthcare better. They don't want to make their lives better. They want to keep them from being trans. So sorry to interrupt. I just had to like get on my soapbox for a second.
Well, sure. And I think another example of a completely ridiculous bill that's being considered is one in Texas, where legislators introduced a bill that would make being transgender literally a form of crime, a felony crime, deeming it fraud. I don't get it. How could that even – that's the one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. I mean, say what you want about whether we should be funding gender-affirming care for young people, but it's a completely different thing to say, not only are we not going to provide your care, we're going to deem you to be a felon.
Yeah. Well, I think people need to look at the practical impact of that bill and what the bill like actually does, because I think it gives you a little more insight into like what they're really trying to do here. Because I think I'm somewhat guilty of this. The headline seems really like splashy, and it is splashy because it's so awful. But we learn a lot more about the bill when we actually read it. And I was grateful for the story that talked about the specifics of it, because it talked about the fact that it's really aimed at employment, at when somebody goes out for a job. Because if you submit like documents that don't match, that's when you would be under scrutiny, right? That's when you would like, mm-hmm. Run afoul of this law, and you would be flagged to potentially be arrested and to be felonized. Is that a word? It is now. But so if you look at that, it's trying to keep people from getting jobs. It's trying to keep people from employment. And it gets to what I was talking about before, that they're trying to make it harder to be trans in every possible aspect of someone's life and someone's healthcare and using the bathroom and going to school and playing freaking sports on a sports team, right? And this, like in this way, they're also making it harder to get a job if you're trans, or they're trying to, because you've got the Supreme Court's Bostock ruling, right, that says that trans people can't be discriminated against in employment, right? So if you land this job, you know, people can't discriminate against you unduly for being trans. You have to be treated the same way as everyone else. It's really easy to skirt that sort of thing because a lot of states are at will, meaning you can just be fired for any reason, right? But you know, there are sort of protections in place for trans people there, at least for the Supreme Court, from the Supreme Court level. And this bill, this proposed law, is really trying to gut that, to say like, oh, we're going to keep you from getting a job at all. We're going to make it impossible for you to take advantage of these protections, because if you try to, you could literally be arrested and become a felon for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So it's just trying to cut off any form of like social support or like economic livelihood for people at any level. They're trying to make it impossible for people to be trans.
Well, thank goodness we have the state of California, where you and I both live, and we seem to be pushing back. How safe do you think we are from what's coming down from the feds?
Oh, God. I feel like DJ Doommeister Gilmore over here, because I know that like that we do live in a liberal bubble here in California, and that's really lovely. For listeners who didn't get this before, I live in LA, and I love living in LA. I love that the sun is always shining here and people get to take the weather for granted. It's fabulous. But you know, I don't think we can take our liberal bubbles for granted, because these policies that are coming out from the Trump administration are federal. Like, they're trying to shut down gender affirming care everywhere, all across the country. Like, hospitals all across the country are being affected. There was a local hospital here in LA that was being protested by advocates because they had stopped offering gender affirming care in the wake of Trump's executive order. So it's like, yeah, we have local protections and state protections that are really important and critical. And I don't want to just dismiss that because I have some respect for the local leaders that are fighting for us. But we have to remember that Trump doesn't just want to shut this stuff down in red states. He wants to shut it down everywhere. Mm-hmm. And also this resurgent MAGA movement, like, it's not just a red state thing. We forget that, you know, 40% of Republican or of California is Republican, right? And not all of those people necessarily align with Trump and align with, like, the MAGA movement. But that means that a lot of people do. And you see that. You see that in places like Glendale that has been recently fighting over LGBTQ inclusion in its schools. You see that in Torrance, which is an LA suburb too, where they decided to take down pride flags from the city light poles, and where a lot of the pride flags there have been vandalized. So it's like, we can pretend that we're protected from this in California and that we don't have to deal with this in the same way that people do in other places, but that's just not true. Like, a woman was stabbed either last year or the year before because she had a pride flag right. hanging outside of her shop. So, like, it is here, and we need to be fighting it too. And if we think that we don't have some role to play, then, like, I don't know. I think that we're really in for it when 2028 comes around too, yeah. Because it's like, if we are not all going to fight against this, if we're not only going to do our part, I think we're going to start seeing it over and over and over again.
Well, I think it's a lot sooner than 2028. I think the next big benchmark is 2026. We have a governor's election coming up. We have an opportunity to try to preserve the ground that we hold. But, you know, to your point, I think just like with Proposition 8 back in 2008, we got complacent. And we were complacent in this election by thinking that there's no way that this guy would get reelected again. And he did. And I think that if we are not involved and attentive and pushing to preserve and fight for our rights in a very active way, that we could see something flip here in California that would not be good for us.
No, I mean, it can happen everywhere, right? Anywhere. California used to be conservative at one time until it wasn't. It was a different kind of conservative, because I just think that the red-blue alignment looks really different than it used to. But you look at Florida, right? Florida used to be solidly purple. It's not anymore. My home state of Ohio used to be purple. It's not anymore. So these things can happen, and they can flip, and they can flip overnight until you're living the place and you just don't recognize it anymore, right? Ohio didn't used to be this place of, like, abortion extremism, and now it is. So it's like, if we want to make sure that that doesn't happen in California, we need to not get complacent, as you're saying. We need to fight.
Yep, that's for sure. So let's talk to our young transgender listeners who are out there. What advice do you have for them in terms of navigating this crazy time?
Oh, God. I hate giving people advice, because I think that just people, like, spout off a lot. And, you know, like, I don't know what happens in other people's lives. You know what I mean? Like, I never know what someone else is going through. I think that that's what this book taught me. It taught me that you just don't really know what's going on in people's lives until you ask. So you should never really assume, right? So I never want to assume anyone else's experience, or that what I know what's best for other people. Mm-hmm. So I want to couch that. But I do want to just say that, you know, all of these people are trying to convince you that it's not okay to be you, and there's not a place for you in this world. Don't listen. Listen to yourself. Like, I think that's the most important thing I've learned through my life, is the importance of listening to myself. There are so many ways that I think I knew myself really early, and I was in a way, like, talked out of my own path and my own voice, and trusting myself. And I ended up being right, you know. I ended up knowing myself better than anybody else did. And there were all of these people who would get in my head and give me this imposter syndrome, I think, about my ability to be my own person and to stand my ground and figure out who I am in this world and how I contribute to it. And for trans kids, I think I just tell them the same thing. Like all those people who are trying to like tell you it's not okay to be you, who are trying to dissuade you from your path, remember that that's about them. Like it's not about you. So often people are doing that based on their own biases and like where they're coming from. And they're often not thinking about us. They're not thinking about what's actually best for us as human beings. They're thinking about themselves. I think most people kind of unfortunately are just thinking about themselves. They're not really thinking about other people. So I think that trans youth are going to get a lot of just like bad advice and bad faith and these bad actors who are intervening throughout their life to try to keep them from being themselves and take them off their path. And you just need to keep going. You just need to keep fighting to be you. And it sucks that you shouldn't, because you shouldn't have to fight this hard. Like, I truly hope that one day trans kids don't have to fight like this for something that should just be a given. They should just be allowed to be who they are. And everyone goes, oh, okay, great. And I hope we get there someday. And I'm going to keep fighting to get there. You know, that's what my work is, right? Creating space for people, creating, you know, trying to work toward a future where no one has to think about this or worry about this. But, you know, in the meantime, before we get there, I just tell, you know, trans kids, just keep going. Like, this world needs you. Yep. So keep fighting for yourself.
Keep fighting. Nico, where can people go to follow you?
Oh, not in real life, I hope. I don't need any more stalkers. But online, Queer News Daily is great. That's my Instagram. That is pretty much the only public social media handle I have. I've got my Facebook. Please don't follow me there. Because I think that people have too much social media. We do not need to know all that, girl. Queer News Daily is the best place to keep up with my work. I post 4 to 5 times a day. So if that's not enough for people, I don't know what else to give you.
Perfect.
But I do want to just say for everybody who does follow me, thank you. It's been sort of like my mental health right now to feel like other people care about what's going on and are trying to do something about this like horrible situation that we find ourselves in. So to everybody who like keeps engaging and, you know, is keeping up the fight, thank you. Because I need that hope right now.
Great. And if scratch that. Great. And we'll put a link to Queer News Daily on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just go to the top of the page, click on show notes, and you will be able to get linked up with what Nico's posting. The book is called American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. And you can find it on any online provider. Where else can people find your book?
Physical bookstores. I love physical bookstores. If you've got a local bookseller, you know, in your city or your neighborhood, definitely go there. If they don't have it in shop, I hope they do because I've been signing book plates for like everybody who wants them. But if not, they can always order it for you. If for some reason you have to go to a Barnes & Noble, there's always that. Just please don't do Amazon. Like, Amazon does not need your money. Jeff Bezos is like doing fine. So don't give that megalomaniac a dime. Please always like shop local and shop small if you can.
Sounds great. Nico Lang, thank you so much for being with us tonight. And most of all, for providing us some insight and some stories that hopefully will change hearts and minds.
Oh God, let's hope so.
And that wraps up our hour. Tune in next Sunday night for an Outbeat Extra with Gary Carnevale. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week. And thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Rohnert Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.